From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
One of the main premises of my book is that the United States, American political leaders, businessmen, were complicit in many of the crimes of Saddam Hussein. And what's interesting is, although the trials of Saddam are still going on, even though he's still not there, his Confederates are still on trial, the mainstream American media isn't talking about this at all.
Web of Deceit, former 60 Minutes investigative producer Barry Lando on the history of Western complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. Then a vast amount of bomb-grade nuclear material is scattered across the globe. It wasn't Kim Jong-il or the Iranian Ayatollahs who put it there. America did. Today, nuclear menace made in the USA, a Chicago Tribune investigation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush has signed a directive that gives the White House much greater control over the rules and policy statements that the government develops to protect public health, safety, the environment, civil rights, and privacy. The New York Times is reporting each agency must now have a regulatory policy office run by a political appointee to supervise the development of rules and to make sure the agencies carry out the president's priorities. Consumer, labor, and environmental groups denounced the directive, saying it gave too much control to the White House and would hinder agencies' efforts to protect the public. Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman of California says the executive order allows the political staff at the White House to dictate decisions on health and safety issues, even if the government's own impartial experts disagree. Today on Capitol Hill, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is holding its first hearing on the political interference in the work of government scientists regarding climate change. Last year, NASA's top climate scientist, James Hansen, accused the Bush administration of trying to stop him from speaking out about the links between greenhouse gases and global warming. Human Rights Watch is urging the United States to stop selling cluster bombs to Israel following the widespread use of U.S.-made cluster munitions during the war in Lebanon last year. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick acknowledged Israel likely violated U.S. arms export agreements when it dropped cluster bombs among villages in Lebanon. This is Mark Galasco of Human Rights Watch.
As a comparison, during the war in Iraq in 2003, the United States, over 3 weeks, dropped 2 million cluster submunitions. Israel, in the war in Lebanon, dropped 4 million in 3 days. It dwarfs any use of cluster bombs prior. You can take Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kosovo and put them together, and you're not going to come close to what happened in southern Lebanon.
Meanwhile, the Israeli military has announced it signed a major new contract with the U.S. military contractor Boeing. Israel plans to spend $100 million to buy a new weapon system that converts conventional bombs into satellite-guided precision weapons. In Iraq, at least 36 Shiite pilgrims have died today in a series of bombings and ambushes aimed to disrupt Ashura, the holiest period of the year for Shiite. Another 5 Shiite worshippers were killed Monday when a rocket-propelled grenade hit a mosque south of Kirkuk. A U.S. medical charity is estimating more than 500,000 people have fled their homes in Baghdad in the last year, and that 1 million more could be forced out in coming months. The International Medical Corps says the pace of people displaced has been rising at a dramatic rate. In Washington, the Brookings Institution is warning the civil war in Iraq could spread throughout the region and disrupt oil production in the Persian Gulf. This is Brookings analyst Kenneth Pollack.
And unfortunately, we're already in Iraq seeing the manifestations of that. There are already domestic disturbances in many of the neighboring states around Iraq. And what's more, all of Iraq's neighbors are now deeply involved supporting different proxy groups inside of Iraq, which is the typical first step before large-scale intervention, before turning a civil war into a regional war.
Kenneth Pala co-wrote the group's new report titled Things Fall Apart. A former Pentagon contractor has been sentenced to 9 years in prison and to pay $3.6 million for his role in a bribery and fraud scheme involving contracts to reconstruct Iraq. The contractor, Robert Stein, served as a regional controller and funding officer for the Coalition Provisional Authority. Stein admits he accepted more than $1 million in cash, sports cars, motorcycle, jewelry, and computers. In addition, he helped steal more than $2 million that had been designated for the reconstruction of Iraq. The Army recently announced it has initiated 50 criminal investigations into the misconduct of private contractors in the war in Iraq. The oil giant Shell has signed a deal with the Iranian government to develop a major gas field in the Persian Gulf. Iran has the second largest reserves of natural gas worldwide after Russia. On Monday, the U.S. State Department said it would likely investigate whether sanctions should be imposed on Shell. John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, is openly advocating regime change in Iran. In an interview with the French newspaper Le Monde, Bolton said negotiations with Iran have failed, and in the long term, quote, the only real solution is regime change. Former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer testified Monday in the perjury and obstruction trial of Scooter Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff. Fleischer said Libby divulged Valerie Plame's identity to him on July 7, 2003, 3 days earlier than Libby has told investigators he first learned of the undercover CIA officer. Newsweek's Michael Isikoff described Fleischer's testimony as the most significant in the case to date. Fleischer is the fifth witness to contradict Libby's version of events. The former New York Times reporter Judith Miller is scheduled to testify today. Kathy Martin finished up her testimony on Monday. She was Dick Cheney's former top press assistant. She's married to Kevin Martin, the chair of the Federal Communications Commission. Israel's carried out its first bombing raid on the Gaza Strip in 2 months. The bombing came one day after a Palestinian suicide bomber killed three people in the Red Sea resort of Eilat. This is Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni.
Unfortunately, in the Palestinian Authority, instead of fight against terrorism, we see a government which is controlled by a terrorist organization. Israel shown restraint in order to give the Palestinians the opportunity to fight terrorism and to stop these terror attacks on Israel.
The Palestinian government defended the suicide attack. This is Hamas official Fawzi Barhom.
All of this type of violence and terrorism against our Palestinian people, let the resistance make this type of operation, resistance operation, in order to make support to our Palestinian issues.
In other news from the region, officials from the Palestinian factions Hamas and Fatah have agreed to a ceasefire to stop the deadly infighting that's killed over 30 Palestinians in recent days. In New Orleans, a protester interrupted a Senate committee hearing Monday dealing with the reconstruction of the Gulf Coast region.
I have 100 signatures of victims of Hurricane Katrina. Why don't you tell them
why? We will...
The protester was holding a sign that read, quote, probe the White House. At the hearing, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin testified he doesn't feel the country has the will to really fix New Orleans in light of how much money is being spent on the war in Iraq. Nagin said, quote, I think it's more class than anything, but there's racial issues associated with it also, he said. On Monday, President Bush defended his decision not to mention New Orleans or Hurricane Katrina during the State of the Union. The city of Miami is making plans to hold an official party at the Orange Bowl to be held following the death of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. A city committee has begun holding planning meetings to discuss logistics for the event. Protests were held in Washington and New Delhi, India, Monday, against the pharmaceutical giant Novartis. The company is seeking to overturn an Indian law regarding drug patents. Demonstrators say if Novartis wins the lawsuit, it'll threaten India's ability to manufacture low-cost generic drugs that are distributed throughout the global south to treat AIDS and other diseases. Monique Wanjala spoke in New Delhi.
I've been living with HIV for the last—this is 13 years now. And I've been on treatment on ARV since 2004. And this is because access has been made easier. And we are saying that if Novartis go through with this case, what does it mean to us as people living with HIV? It means that our lives are at stake.
In Washington, activists from Global AIDS Alliance tried to deliver a mini coffin to the downtown office of Novartis. 15 human rights activists were sentenced Monday for taking part in a protest last November against the Army School of the Americas, now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Most of the activists were sentenced to 2 to 3 months in federal prison. One received a 6-month sentence. Over 200 people have served time in prison over the past decade for engaging in nonviolent resistance against the Army Training Center that has been linked to many human rights abuses throughout Latin America. And in Washington, 9 anti-war protesters were arrested Monday when they gathered in a House office building in Capitol Hill. They were arrested while reading off the names of Americans and Iraqis killed in the war. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Army's agreed to drop 2 misconduct charges against Iraq war resister First Lieutenant Aaron Watada. The agreement knocks 2 years from a maximum 6-year prison sentence that he's facing at a court-martial scheduled to begin next week in Fort Lewis, Washington. Lieutenant Watada is the first commissioned officer to refuse to serve in the Iraq war. As part of the agreement, the Army has dropped its subpoena of 2 journalists in exchange for Lieutenant Watada's admission that he made statements critical of the Iraq war. In an effort to prove those statements in court, the Army had subpoenaed independent journalists Sarah Olson and Greg Coxsackio of the Honolulu Star-Bulletin and was prepared to compel them to testify or face up to 6 months in prison under contempt charges. Last week, I interviewed Lieutenant Watada and asked him about the issue of press freedom in his case.
That once you start using reporters to testify against their sources, not just war resisters, what whistleblowers, what minority opinions will be willing to go out there and testify to reporters in order to get the truth out if they know that the government will use those reporters to testify against them? And I think that becomes very dangerous in our society, and it's going to have a chilling effect. It's going to stifle free speech. It's going to stifle people having the courage to bring the truth out, and it's going to stifle the freedom of the press.
A petition against the Army subpoenas of the journalists in Watada's case had drawn widespread support. Sarah Olson is one of the 2 journalists. She joins me on the line right now from Oakland, California. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you got this news late last night, at least Eastern time. Can you talk about the significance of this subpoena being dropped against you?
Sure. Well, you know, I think that this is really a victory for the rights of journalists in the United States to gather up and to disseminate news really free from government intervention. I think also, just as importantly, it's a victory for the rights of people, individuals, to express personal political opinions to journalists without fear of retribution or censure. I'm really glad that the growing number of dissenting voices within the military retain their rights to speak with reporters. And I'm also a little bit concerned that Lieutenant Watada still faces prosecution for exercising his First Amendment rights during public presentations. I also think that the preservation of these rights for journalists and for individuals clearly requires vigilance. Journalists are subpoenaed today in the U.S. with an alarming frequency. For example, 25-year-old journalist and videographer Josh Wolf has been languishing in federal prison since this summer. He's currently been in prison for over 160 days after refusing to turn over his unpublished video outtakes to grand jury investigators. Investigating a 2005 anti-capitalist protest. So I think that we obviously need to continue to demand that the separation between the press and the government is strong, and that the press be a platform for all perspectives, regardless of their popularity with the current administration.
Sarah Olson, now that you will not be compelled to testify, though there was a serious question whether you would have or you would have refused, will you cover the court-martial of Aaron Watada that's expected to take place on February 5th next week?
Well, you know, I really look forward to kind of thinking about that as a possibility. When I was subpoenaed, I was, you know, obviously no longer able to cover the Lieutenant Watada's story, and I certainly look forward to being able to do so in the future. I think his case raises important questions. I think it deserves additional coverage, and I look forward to thinking about that and seeing whether or not that's a possibility.
Sarah Olson, thanks for joining us. Independent journalist and radio producer, the subpoena has been dropped for her to testify at the Lieutenant Aaron Watada court-martial next week. As we move on to our next story, thanks, Sarah. 1 month has passed since the execution of Saddam Hussein. The Iraqi dictator was hanged for ordering the killing of 148 Shiite villagers in 1982. His death drew a mixed response. In Iraq, widely celebrated by Shia and Kurds, while condemned by the Sunni community he came from. Around the world, British Prime Minister Tony Blair was among those to applaud Hussein's death, but to condemn the way he was executed. Less vocal or heard were those critics who said Saddam was executed before he could stand trial for his worst atrocities. A just trial, these critics say, would have also charged or subpoenaed many of the world leaders, arms merchants, and oil companies that supported him. Well, today we look at the trial that could have been. My next guest is the author of Web of Deceit, the history of Western complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. Barry Lando is a veteran journalist. He spent 25 years as an award-winning investigative producer for 60 Minutes. He joins us here in the Firehouse studio. Who do you think should have been tried alongside Saddam Hussein?
Well, depending on what crimes we're talking about, there's all kinds of crimes that he committed during his reign. But if we start with the trial that is actually still going on now, though I think many of us have forgotten that although Saddam is not there, the trials continue in Baghdad.
Explain how that is happening without him.
Well, because he wasn't the only one who guilty. In other words, his commanders, military commanders, other people who worked with him in Iraq, his confederates, were also, he didn't commit these crimes single-handedly, as Hitler didn't either. So although Hitler wasn't there, the Nuremberg trials proceeded, and other people were judged and hung after those trials. The same thing is going on in Baghdad today. And the trial that is going on right now is for the genocidal attacks against the Kurds in Iraq in the late 1980s by Saddam and his military commanders. And what is forgotten, though, is the complicity of the United States and America. If we're dealing with chemical weapons, it's also the case, some American and basically European companies in supplying some of the weapons to Saddam. When the genocidal attacks began in the late 1980s, and one of the most notorious was the attack in the village of Halabja, when chemical weapons were used, in March 1988. When that happened, the United States turned its back on those crimes. They tried to pretend that they hadn't happened. When the U.S. Congress wanted to condemn Saddam for using chemical weapons, and the Reagan and then the Bush administrations attempted to protect Saddam to prevent the Congress from initiating sanctions against them.
Didn't senators at that time, including Robert Dole, go meet with Saddam Hussein?
Right. The senators from the agricultural states went to meet with Saddam because the U.S. agricultural producers, rice farmers, wheat farmers, were supplying hundreds of millions of dollars worth of grain to Saddam. And they wanted that to continue.
This was at a time when they understood that he had used chemical weapons.
Absolutely. Right.
It's interesting to note that on the floor of the Senate in the debate over the authorization of the current Iraq war, what happened in the late 1980s was raised hundreds of times. Yet when it came to the Persian Gulf War that George Bush Sr. presided over, that was hardly used as a rationale, which was just a few years after what you're describing. Perhaps because of the Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons in the late 1980s, when we're talking about the war of 1990-1991,
right,
because at the time Bush and Reagan were a part of allowing that to happen and stopping the sanctions.
Well, they wanted to continue relations with Saddam. They had reports about what a tyrant he was. But Bush, first Reagan, and then Bush wanted to continue U.S. relations with Iraq. They saw Iraq as a fantastic market for the United States. It had the petroleum wealth. It had to rebuild after the war with Iran. And they thought that the United States businesses, high-tech corporations, wheat farmers, rice farmers, all could take advantage of these fantastic opportunities. There were others in the administration, in the Bush administration, who were arguing, no, this guy, he's a bad actor, and we should have nothing to do with him. But George Bush Sr. and James Baker pushed all along to keep good relations with Saddam and to have hundreds of millions of dollars of loans made to Saddam so that he could continue to buy, purchase from the outside world, including very sophisticated weapons or material that could be used to construct weapons of mass destruction. There were Pentagon warnings that went to the Bush administration saying the Iraqis are buying material from us that can be used for weapons of mass destruction, and Bush and Baker made sure that those sales continued to go through, despite those warnings.
We're talking to Barry Lando. His book is Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. We'll be back with him in a minute. جسد أشبه شيء بالخيال وفؤادي عن هواكم غير سالي وفؤادي عن هواكم غير نظم الليالي لثغور النظمات نظم الليالي ليلى هومر by Omar Taufik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Barry Lando, his book is called Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. He's a former investigative producer for 60 Minutes on CBS and runs the blog barrylando.com. You're talking about the Bush-Reagan years. Let's go back a little further, which actually brings us up to the present, because in 1983, 1984, there's the two famous visits of Donald Rumsfeld, then the envoy for Reagan and Bush, to Saddam Hussein, shaking his hands. Talk about what was known at that time and what he was doing there.
Well, in 1983, the Iraqis were already using chemical weapons against the Iranian troops. They were already at war with Iran. They'd been at war with them for about 3 years. And the Iranians were using kind of mass formations, child warriors running at the Iraqi lines. And so they found chemical weapons were quite effective. The Iraqis did. And the U.S. knew this. And at the time, Iran asked for the United Nations to investigate the use of these illegal weapons. And the United States, I think England as well, helped block any attempt by the United Nations to investigate this. This is back in 1983. This is 5 years before they used it in Halabja. And at the same time, Donald Rumsfeld was sent, as you say, by Ronald Reagan as a special envoy to talk with Saddam Hussein, because the U.S. didn't have relations with Iraq at that point. They had cut them a few years earlier over the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, and that Saddam was apparently was supporting terrorists. So the United States had cut diplomatic relations with Iraq. Rumsfeld went there to see if they could warm things up, because the United States wanted to help Iraq. They didn't want Iran to win the war. Also, they wanted Saddam's help for political problems that they were having in Lebanon at the time. So Rumsfeld went there, and he had a warning, a long briefing paper from the State Department. One of the things concerned Saddam's use of chemical weapons. Rumsfeld talked about that with Saddam's foreign minister, Tariq Aziz, but when he met with Saddam over an hour, he talked about all kinds of other subjects, but didn't bring up the subject of chemical weapons at all. And so 5 or 6 years later, when the Saddam used chemical weapons against the Kurds, when one of the Iraqis questioned one of the commanders who was going to use them, the man who became known as Chemical Ali, said, the rest of the world, who cares about the rest of the world if we use chemical weapons? In other words, he already knew from their experience with the Iranians that the world would say nothing if they continued to use chemical weapons against their own people. And that, in fact, was the case.
And these are now the trials that are taking place today.
Well, the trial that's going on right now involves the genocide of the Kurds, which involved chemical weapons and mass executions, population, incredible forced movements of populations. You know, the U.S. did absolutely nothing when those were occurring.
So what was the rationale for executing him before he was fully tried?
I don't know what the actual rationale was. No one really explained. The first trial they put on, the Dujai trial, was for relatively minor, I think 165 people who were killed in the after there had been an assassination attempt against Saddam. But it kind of got him out of the way to execute him afterwards. First of all, he remained a symbol for the Sunnis. So I think the Shiites wanted to get him out of the way. I don't really feel it was to cover up foreign complicity in the other trials that are going to come. I think they just wanted Saddam out of the way. I think the way the tribunal has been set up from the beginning basically protects the United States and other countries from being accused.
How?
Well, the tribunal has basically been set up by the United States. The U.S. Finances the tribunal. It trained the judges. It trained the lawyers, the prosecutors. There was also a special provision in the statute of the tribunal that the press seems to have ignored, and that is that only Iraqi citizens or Iraqi residents can be accused. In other words, foreigners cannot be brought before the tribunal.
We're talking to Barry Lando, Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. Whether it was the intent or not, once Saddam Hussein is taken out of the picture, there's almost no international or at least U.S. press attention on these trials that are continuing, which means that complicity...
Well, you know, that's true, but except I've been, I guess because I'm obsessed by the subject, I've been following the press pretty closely. The New York Times, The Post, The Los Angeles Times, Associated Press are all continuing to cover these crimes, the trials that are going on, the ones against the Kurds right now. Later on this year, there'll be another trial, too, for even more killings. What has amazed me is that the press, particularly the American press, has made not a mention of American complicity in these crimes. And frankly, I don't understand why.
I want to go back in time, Barry Lando, because you start The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush. Talk about how Iraq was formed, the current modern state of Iraq, and the central role of oil.
Well, it was formed out of the collapsing Ottoman Empire at the end of World War I. The British and the French went in to kind of divide up much of the Ottoman Empire, and the British took essentially what is Iraq today. It was three provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And they put them together around 1920-21 into one country, which became known as Iraq. These were peoples who had lived under the Ottoman Empire, but they had never been put together into one state, sort of living side by side politically and administratively. And it was a recipe for disaster. The British were warned about it at the time. But the reason they wanted to put these people, the Shiites, the Sunnis, and particularly the Kurds, in one place is the British wanted the petroleum, particularly the petroleum that the Kurds had. Kurdistan is a major petroleum area. They suspected, they weren't pumping petroleum at the time, but they knew that it was there. And the British wanted that. And they also wanted bases, too, in that part of the world to protect Persia, which was an important part of the British Empire, and India. So bases there became very important for them, too. So you had two things, petroleum and military bases, which are basically exactly the same motives, I think, that are keeping the United States in that part of the world today.
How did the U.S. first get involved with Iraq?
They came in as the British Empire was weakening, beginning to fall apart in the 50s. The United States became active in that part of the world. And as the Cold War was going on, too, they looked at any attempts by leaders in that part of the world to become more independent from the West, to get more of their own, take more of their own oil, petroleum resources for the benefit of their own country, to seek any kind of outside help from the Soviets. That became a sign that these people had to go. You had Eisenhower, Dulles. The CIA went in and overthrew leaders in that part of the world at that time.
John F. Kennedy and the CIA in Iraq?
Well, before Kennedy, you had Eisenhower and Dulles, too. The overthrow of Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran. Then you had John Kennedy. In 1963, you had a nationalist ruler in Iraq, Qassem, and the Kennedys, the CIA, and the Egyptians, who also didn't like him, joined together, and they helped organize a coup in Iraq. It overthrew Qassem. The Ba'ath Party, which was Saddam Hussein was then a junior member of the Ba'ath Party, came into power. They were, the U.S. liked them at the time. They were secular, strongly anti-communist, anti-Soviet, so they were seen as allies by the CIA. So when they took over in 1963, the CIA supplied them with lists of suspected communists, militants, left-wing intellectuals, professionals, to be taken care of. They were picked up, tortured, and many of them were killed. We're talking about hundreds, maybe thousands of people. Saddam Hussein then was one of the young torturers at that time.
And then explain how he rose to power.
Well, then back in the Ba'ath fell out of power again in 1968. There was another coup, and they came back in. And Saddam became the power behind the throne. It took him 10 years to become formally head of Iraq, of the government in Iraq, but for most of that time, he was already seen as the man behind the throne. He ran the secret police, and he used Stalinist methods to take over. He was a great admirer of Stalin. So in 1979, Saddam formally became the leader of Iraq.
President Carter's role here?
Well, at this time, Khomeini had come to power in Iran. After the Shah was overthrown, Khomeini came to power. He was seen as an enemy of the United States, which he was. And you had the hostages taken. The American hostages were taken from the embassy in Iran. And so Carter wanted to do anything he could to weaken Khomeini. So did the other states of the Gulf. The Saudis, the Kuwaitis were terrified of Khomeini and what he could represent to their hold on that region, because Khomeini viewed them as dictators, and he was for the national taking over the oil petroleum resources of those countries as well, not for himself, but for the people of those countries. He represented a major threat. So Jimmy Carter encouraged Saddam via the Saudis to invade Iran. That started a war which lasted for 8 years, longest war of the 20th century, resulted in at least a million people dying on both sides. And of course, the United States, other Western countries, the Soviets sold arms, continued to support the Iraqis during that period. And when it looked though that the Iraqis might win, because they didn't want either side to win really, they also sold arms to the Iranians as well. So the battle kind of went back and forth for 8 years, with many countries selling arms to both sides. And the United States, in fact, even gave intelligence aid to both sides. And in the end, as I said, a million people died because of that war.
Gave intelligence on where Iranian soldiers were to be gassed by Saddam Hussein.
Exactly. The U.S. Gave satellite information to basically more to the Iraqis, enabling them to target Iranian troop concentrations, even though the U.S. knew that the Iranians were using chemical weapons. The Iraqis were using chemical weapons.
Can you talk about the effect of the sanctions period, largely through President Clinton?
Yeah, well, that started after Saddam had been thrown thrown out of Kuwait, and you had an uprising took place that was just a whole other story.
Well, speak briefly about that uprising, because it's very significant for Iraqi's view of the United States, too, and it involved President Bush Sr.
Yeah, to me, the uprising and what happened is really key, to, in a way, to what's going on there today. As Saddam had invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, and the United States moved then to push him out of Kuwait, when they did, George Bush called on the people of Iraq publicly. He called on them to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein. This call was relayed by the CIA secret radio stations all over Iraq. And U.S. airplanes also dropped millions of pamphlets over Iraq telling the people of Iraq to rise up and overthrow Saddam. And they did. And the uprising spread like wildfire across southern Iraq. The Kurds, all these were among the Shiites, the Kurds also rose up. But then the U.S., Bush Sr. and James Baker became worried because they realized they weren't going to be able to control this uprising. They had wanted a military coup, a nice, neat military coup that in the end they could really control. But what in fact happened was a popular revolt. They were worried that perhaps Iran would come in, would try to make use of it, that the Kurds would try to set up an independent country that would disturb Turkey, their allies, that the Saudis wouldn't like what was going on there. And so they turned their back on the uprising. They allowed Saddam to continue using his helicopters to attack the villages and the Shiites, who had no way of fighting back against these helicopters. And when the Shiites came to American lines, I spoke to a special forces officer who was just a few kilometers away from where the uprising was going on. You had the Shiites coming to the American lines and saying, look, we're not asking you to fight for us, just give us weapons. We will fight ourselves. The Americans had hundreds of millions of dollars of arms that they had seized from the defeated Iraqi military. They destroyed those weapons rather than turn them over to the rebels. In another case, we were told that they blocked one rebel column from trying to march on Baghdad. They refused to meet with any of the insurgent leaders who were desperately trying to talk to the Americans. The Americans refused to even talk to them on the Kurdish side and on the Shiite side. So finally, the revolt was over, and Saddam came in and slaughtered anywhere from 100 to 150,000 Shiites.
Given this history, and this is my last question to you, what do you think America owes Iraq?
I think what they owe Iraq is to stop trying to tell the Iraqis what to do, to stop interfering in the politics of that country. The problem is that they've destroyed the country, too. They've taken apart any kind of national glue, if you will, that had begun to grow up among the Iraqis, a feeling of nationalism. That's been destroyed by this invasion. The country has been really ripped apart. And now it's extremely difficult to know what to do, because they are on the verge of this. There's already a civil war. They're on the verge of a much greater cataclysm now. There is no easy way out. The Baker Commission said there's no way out that will not entail more bloodshed.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Barry Lando has written the book Web of Deceit, The History of Western Complicity in Iraq, from Churchill to Kennedy to George W. Bush, former investigative producer for CBS's 60 Minutes. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
رحماني غريبة من بعد عينك يا يما محتارة بزماني وياه اللي رحمت حالي يا يما لو دهري رماني حاجيني يا يما فهميني يا يما حاجيني يا يما فهميني. غريبة من بعد عانت يا يما يما محتارة بزمان غريبة من بعد عانت يا يما محتارة بزمان وياه اللي يرحم حالي يا يما لو دهري رماني غريبة من بعد عينك يا يما.
I'm Amer Taufik here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations in the two TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. The specter of nuclear warfare waged by North Korea or Iran has hung over the world in recent months. But beyond that fear and foreboding looms a far more far-reaching threat, the vast amount of nuclear bomb-grade material scattered across the globe. And it wasn't Kim Jong-il or the Ayatollahs of Iran who put it there. America did. Those are the opening lines of a new exposé by the Chicago Tribune. The investigation has found several tons of U.S. nuclear bomb-grade material distributed under the Cold War Atoms for Peace program remains scattered across the planet. The U.S. government has failed to retrieve 40 tons of highly enriched uranium, enough to make over 1,400 nuclear weapons, while the Bush administration says it's trying to remove weapons-grade fuel from several research reactors around the world. Many nuclear experts believe the U.S. does not know how much enriched uranium exists abroad, or even where it exists. Sam Rowe is a staff reporter at the Chicago Tribune, author of this investigative series, joining us from Chicago. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
Why don't you start off with this latest story that we've been getting in the news about the possibility that someone in the old Soviet Union now had weapons-grade nuclear material?
Yeah, that was a case that just came out last week where someone was caught having a small amount of highly enriched uranium in plastic bags in his coat pocket. And what's significant about that is that highly enriched uranium is the holy grail of nuclear materials. It's the one thing that you can easily make a bomb with. It doesn't take much technical expertise if you have enough to create nuclear fission. So that's why there's so much worry about highly enriched uranium. Secondly, it's easy to transport, so if someone can just put it in their pocket and walk across the border, that's of great concern. That case was really interesting because for the last few years, there really hasn't been a lot of nuclear smuggling cases, but that's been, you know, that was one of the most recent one and most disturbing one.
Describe, Sam Rowe, the Atoms for Peace program.
The Atoms for Peace program really was this bold experiment by President Eisenhower, unveiled in 1953. And the concept was that the United States would distribute nuclear technology around the world to other nations if they promised not to build nuclear weapons. So it was this grand bargain. At the time, you know, we had nuclear weapons, and we thought, and rightly so, that other nations would eventually build weapons on their own, so why not cut a deal now? Why not get some kind of control over this? And the Soviet Union saw what we were doing, and so they decided to follow suit, and you had this really interesting sort of Cold War chess match going around where the United States and the Soviet Union, they were both supplying research reactors and nuclear technology and highly enriched uranium all throughout the world, and that's the material that's out there today. That's the material that we're so concerned about.
What role does the IAEA play, the International Atomic Energy Agency, in monitoring this?
Well, they can monitor some countries, and they do go out to some sites, and they do check on quantities of material and make sure there's not certain infractions. But, and this isn't discussed much, but they're really underfunded, and they only have, you know, so many staff members to go out to some of these places. And, you know, as we've seen in Iran and other places, sometimes they're just told, you know, go away or we'll come back another time. And so when you look at the big picture, there's not a whole a lot of monitoring of this material around the world, not as much as there should be.
Samro, can you tell us the story of Armando Trevelli?
Armando Trevelli is an interesting character because, remarkably, he and he alone sort of led this effort over the last quarter century to go out and try to get this highly enriched uranium back in U.S. hands. And he himself is an interesting story. He grew up in sort of the war-torn rubble of World War II in Italy, and as a child, you know, he was part of that new atomic age where he thought that someday everything would be run by nuclear energy, you know, cars, boats, planes, everything. And when he came to the United States because he wanted to be part of this new nuclear generation and quickly rose to become a star in the nuclear engineering field out here outside of Chicago at Argonne National Labs, designing some of the largest research reactors you know ever conceived of. And then once India detonated its bomb in 1974 using some of this Atoms for Peace material that was distributed by Canada and the U.S., suddenly the United States wanted to get this material back. And they couldn't just go into all these countries and with guns a-blazing demand it back or take it back by force because we had sold it or leased it or given it away. It wasn't ours anymore. And so we had to find some way to sort of swap it out. We had to find some way to convince these countries to give the material back. And so they came to Armando Trevelli, and they said, can you as a scientist help us with this problem? Can you take this diplomatic quandary that we're in and invent new fuels? Can you invent something that all these other countries can use in these reactors around the world instead of highly enriched uranium? And he said, yeah, that can be done. And they said, well, you lead this charge. Will you invent these fields and then go to these countries and sort of play diplomat and persuade them to use this new material? And he was somewhat taken aback because his life's work was to, you know, spread nuclear technology, not to rein it in. He really believed in nuclear technology. But he was convinced that it was silly to have this bomb-grade material spread around the world. So he decided to do it. He decided to make the rest of his life this quest to get all of this material back.
And explain his relationship with Romania.
Romania is a really interesting case because it was one of the first assignments that he was given by the State Department. This was back in the early 1980s when the dictator Ceausescu was still involved in Romania, still running the country. But the dictator offered, we'll give you back your highly enriched uranium, America. You know, come on down and let's talk about it. So Armando went to Romania and looked at the reactor to see if maybe they could swap out some material in that reactor for the highly enriched uranium. But the United States, remarkably enough, the whole mission sort of bogged down over money. The Romanians wanted the U.S. to pony up some money to pay for it, and the United States wasn't willing to do that, and it bogged down for a number of years. And while that was going on, the reactor and the people in the reactor, Romanian government, used that reactor that the U.S. supplied and the highly enriched uranium to separate plutonium, which is the first step to make an atomic bomb. There's no other reason to separate plutonium than to start a nuclear weapons program. So, you know, that just shows you there's a really lesson of the Atoms for Peace legacy. If you let this stuff sit out there too long, you know, those kinds of things might happen. Eventually, the Romanian government, once Ceausescu was executed in 89, they acknowledged what had happened, and there were some additional safeguards put in place. But some of that uranium still actually remains in Romania.
And other countries that he is associated with, for example, Taiwan.
In Taiwan, that was an interesting case, too. Canada had supplied India with the reactor that India used to build its first atomic weapon. And an identical nuclear facility was given to Taiwan from Canada. And so the Americans were suspicious that Taiwan was also building nuclear weapons. In Canada, they were embarrassed by what just happened in India. They didn't want to have this come out that, you know, now another Canadian reactor might be sparking a nuclear weapons program. So the United States offered to intervene and went there to take a look at this reactor, and Armando Trevelli was in charge. He went there and just shocked at what he saw. From the outside, this reactor in Taiwan looked like your typical reactor. It had a domed roof, and it was windowless and made out of cement. But when he stepped inside, it was very eerie. It was
It was dark, and it had this green tint to it, and it had this Chinese music piped in, not the typical thing you'd see in a reactor. And rising out of the middle of the reactor was this 30-foot tomb-like structure, just this huge concrete block, almost like a Chinese temple. And he and his team just slowly walked toward it with their hosts, and they checked everything out. There's no research going on. There's no scientists around or any kind of experiments that they could see of. And when he walked outside, he said to his colleagues, Armando said to his colleagues, you know, that's a machine for making plutonium. There's no other reason for that. So over the next few years, they went back and forth to Taiwan, and the Taiwanese eventually got tired of the scrutiny and shut the place down.
Samro, how easy is it to transport nuclear material?
Well, with the highly rich uranium, it's quite easy because it's not highly radioactive. So if you had this holy grail of bomb material, you could put it in your pocket and you could carry it around with you and it's not going to harm you. And you could cross borders with relative ease. Once it's been burned in a reactor, then it's highly radioactive. And it would take some technical skill to steal it and get away with it. But one of the issues is that some of the fuel that has been burned in these reactors overseas has sat there for so long, it's not highly radioactive anymore. If something sits around for 30 years, if highly rich uranium is burned in a reactor and it sits there for 30 years, it can be stolen and spirited away quite easily. So there needs to be more attention paid to that material, too.
The Russian man that allegedly was trying to sell uranium had hidden it in two plastic bags in his pocket that the Georgian authorities found?
Yeah, that just shows you how easily you can spirit this stuff away. And that's why highly enriched uranium is something we should all pay attention to. One, it's the one thing you can use to easily make a bomb. And two, you can hide it and transport it easily. If terrorists could get their hands on it, it would be hard to detect. And so that's why there's a push in this country and some other places to do an inventory, do a global inventory of where is highly enriched uranium. You know, it's the one thing that could blow up the world. Why not get a better handle on every place it is in the world? And not just secure it, not just put up locks and fences, because ultimately that may not prevent an inside job because it's so valuable. Somebody may, even guarding it, may decide to steal it and sell it. Why not destroy it all? Why not take it and dilute it down, blend it down into something that can't be made a bomb? That's what a lot of folks are calling for now.
You begin your article with that very provocative paragraph about the specter of nuclear warfare being waged by North Korea or Iran hanging over the world in recent months, but it's not the Kim Jong-il or the Ayatollahs of Iran who put it there. America did. Go more into that, the U.S. and Iran and nuclear weapons.
Well, I think most people, when they talk about loose nukes or they think about the issue, they think in terms of this is a problem that is overseas, or this is something that the Soviets created, or something like that. But we have to remember this is sort of a problem that we created in the first place. This was a problem of our own making. And over the last 30 years, America hasn't done a good job of getting this material under control. And one story that's really went under the radar screen is the reactor, one of the reactors in Iran that's come under scrutiny, was actually provided to Iran in the first place by the United States under the Shah. I wrote about this last year, that back in the 70s, the United States gave Iran a research reactor and highly enriched uranium. And that reactor in recent years has been one of the places where the Iranians have done some things where the IAEA says were infractions. So the United States complains about how Iran is violating international rules and creating a nuclear weapons program and such, you know, some of these infractions have taken place in a reactor that we provided them in the first place.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Sam Rowe, staff reporter. His series on the U.S. Cold War program, Atoms for Peace, is featured this week in the Chicago Tribune, and we will link to it. Thanks for joining us from Chicago.
Thanks for having me.
As we end today with one of our top stories in Iraq, at least 36 Shia pilgrims have died in a series of bombings and ambushes aimed to disrupt Ashura, the holiest period of the year for Shia. Another five Shiite worshippers were killed Monday when Iraq rocket-propelled grenade hit a mosque south of Kirkuk. We're joined right now in Baghdad by Borzu Dargahi. He is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, can you give us the latest news right now in the Iraqi capital?
Well, as you mentioned, it's been a series of mortar attacks and bombings, mostly targeting Shiite civilians, many of them pilgrims, celebrating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the Ashura festival, which wraps up today. There are also reports of mortar attacks on Sunni neighborhoods and a Sunni shrine, the Imam Adam Temple in northern Baghdad. So it's just ongoing sectarian warfare. The streets are relatively empty because of the holiday. Kind of spooky out there.
Borzu, you most recently wrote about the Iraqi and U.S. forces killing several hundred fighters apparently planning an attack on the Shia Muslim shrine in the holy city of Najaf. Describe what you know.
Well, there's a lot we don't know. We don't have a lot of ground truth on what's happening here. We have a lot of official comments from officials down there in a neighboring province and also from the capital, essentially saying that there was this Shiite messianic cult. They were recruiting from Sunnis and foreigners as well. They were holed up in this village. They had suspicions about this village. They went over there. Something happened. There was an altercation. Fighting broke out. They started routing the Iraqi troops. Iraqi troops called for U.S. backup. Eventually, airstrikes came in and killed a whole bunch of people.
And you know who those people are?
Well, according to Iraqi officials, according to some of the other people that we talked to who are corroborating that information, they are members of a group called Heaven's Army, or the Soldiers of Heaven, a cult led by a charismatic young guy who claimed that he was the second coming of a Shiite saint.
Borzu, you've been in Iraq for a long time now. What effect, what has been the reaction to, and what evidence there is there right now of the escalation of war, of the increased troops, soldiers already coming in from the U.S.?
Well, I think that there's been no evidence of U.S. Forces increasing their activities at this point. As a matter of fact, I tend to know that during these religious holidays, the U.S. forces try to keep a lower profile because they know that their presence is offensive to certain pious people. But what we have seen is an apparent escalation in the types of attacks that the insurgents are carrying out. It seems like there's more and more attacks on Shiite civilians over the past couple of weeks. There was a little lull in the number of dead bodies. There were, you know, we believe generally caused by Shiite death squads. Those numbers have gone up as well. So just overall an increase in the intensity of the bloodbath.
There were major protests in the United States, particularly in Washington, D.C., estimates of tens of thousands to half a million protesting the escalation of war in Iraq, calling for the troops to come home. Did it get any coverage? Was there any reaction from Iraqis in Baghdad?
I mean, the Iraqi people in general, they're under so much pressure and they're suffering so much. You know, there was a little bit of TV coverage on the international Arabic satellite channels. Most people are just basically trying to get past the next checkpoint.
Borzu Dargahi, I want to thank you very much for being with us in Baghdad. He's the bureau chief there for the Los Angeles Times. As we wrap up today's broadcast on February 10th, on Friday night, Saturday night, I'll be at the Gleason Performing Arts Center at Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Belkadush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, Anna Nagera, Anuradha Bhagwati, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marcilio, and Miguel Nagera, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Uri Gallet, Hugh Grant, John Randolph, Peter Yoon, Jerome Bourgeois, Samantha Chambly. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.